Thank you. So welcome to the Sunday night There Is a Solution newcomer and returning members meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. Visit our website at oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep the special service active. The opinions expressed are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. We will now introduce a member who has at least 6 months of abstinence, has recovered through the directions in the Big Book, and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After this share, there will be a time to make comments or ask a question about the OA program or what the speaker has shared. So please help me welcome Crystal P., a compulsive overeater from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Thank you. Welcome, Crystal.
Thanks, Donna. Hi, I'm Crystal P., recovered compulsive overeater from Toronto, Canada. Thank you so much for inviting me to speak today. I always begin by saying that what I'm going to share today is not my story. Because if what I was going to share was my story, it would have been the story of a girl who died at around 30 years of age, way too soon. Today, I get to share the story of what God has done for me. You know, the first time that I was asked to speak, I was so excited. You know, I went to my sponsor and I was like, oh my gosh, they've asked me to speak. And she said, okay, you know what the Big Book tells you to do? What does it tell you to do? And so I pull out my Big Book. I'm like, I know it's on page 58. It says we're supposed to tell them, you know, what it was like, what happened and what it's like now. And she said, no, that's not right. And I'm like, I'm sure that's what it says on page 58. And she said, pull out your Big Book and open it up to page 58. And sure enough, that's what it did not say that. It said, we're supposed to share what I was like, what happened and what I am like now, not what it was like, what happened and what it is like now. Because I spent my whole life thinking that the problem was it. If something out there, some it could just get better, if it could just change, if it could just be different, then I would be okay. And what I've come to find in program that the problem is right here, it's in me. And until this gets fixed, everything inside me, doesn't matter what sort of happens with it outside, it'll make no difference. The only path to recovery is right here in me, because that's where the problem is. So what I was like before I joined program four and a little bit years ago, I was over 250 pounds. I'm only 5 feet tall. So that's a significant amount of weight on a very short person. Many people in program talk about how food is very loud and, you know, the food will yell at you and call at you. And food was never loud for me. Why? It didn't need to scream at all. Like every night I would come home from work and I would hear this really soft voice be like, you know, it'd be really great. Like we could stop at Wendy's and then we could stop at Baskin Robbins. And I didn't even bother fighting it. I just knew, you know, why bother? I know I'm going to end up there anyways. I'd gotten to the point where I didn't make any promises anymore. I never woke up in the morning thinking, okay, you know, Monday morning, I'm going to start that diet. I'm not going to eat this, you know, and then, oh my gosh, by night I've thrown it all away. I woke up Monday morning knowing I was going to binge on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I had made a decision that I was going to binge my life through, and I was long gone with diets and promises to myself. I just decided this was going to be my life. I got myself very sick. When you are 5 feet tall and 250 pounds, I was in the ER more often than anyone who's 30 years old should be in an ER. My disease had caused such a terrible anemia that there were days like it felt like I was asphyxiating. Like there would be days when I had such bad shortness of breath that like in a 5 hour period, I could maybe take two breaths that went all the way down to my lungs. That is terrifying. And honestly, that didn't make a single difference as to how much of food I was going to eat or what food I was going to eat. It didn't matter. None of it mattered. I just needed the food. Emotionally, I was like a little child. I don't know how it's possible you could be like this 3-year-old girl inside a 30-year-old woman's body, but that's exactly what I was. I was like a little child. I'd never grown up, never knew how to do things I didn't want to do, never knew how to do things that were hard. I was like a shell of a human being. My whole life revolved around my couch right there and whatever, you know, crinkly bag my hand was in. And that was my whole, and Netflix, that was my whole world, you know. My relationships were non-existent. Other people were in relationships with me. I was not in relationship with anybody because I didn't show up for anybody. I didn't accept anybody. Everybody was a little project. Everybody had a job. Everybody's job was to keep me safe. And if you don't act exactly right, not only about the way you treat me, but in your own life, if you didn't act exactly right, that made me feel unsafe and you needed to fix it. You need to change it. And I once heard an AA speaker say, you know, that we alcoholics, we don't have relationships. We take hostages. And that's exactly what my life was like. Everyone in my life was a hostage. And the gun to their head was either you do what I think you need to do so that I will feel safe, or I'm going to self-destruct. That was all of my relationships. And those are not relationships. Spiritually, I was possibly the most religious person you will meet on the planet. I was literally a couple of minutes from being canonized Saint Crystal. Like I was very, very, very religious. Everyone in my life knew I was going to become a nun. My parents and my uncles and aunts would come to me and say, Crystal, can you please pray for us? You know, that's just how religious I was. I've given a talk to like 18,000 people about my faith. That was kind of the level of religiousness. So it was quite a shock to me when I came into program and found out that I really had no real relationship with God at all. That I said I believed in God and I prayed to this God, and there was only one God in my life, and that was me. And I was possibly the worst God you could ever imagine, like exacting, punishing. I remembered every wrong thing I ever did. Nothing I ever did was good enough. I was horrible, horrible. And this was the God I lived with my whole life, which was me. You know, so it was a complete shock to come into program and realize. It's funny, you know, when I came into program, I remember thinking to myself, like, you know, 95% of my life is really, really good. Like I've got, you know, I love my friends. I've got a good, you know, set of clothes, even though I'm, you know, plus size, I buy expensive clothes because I have a good job. My work is giving me awards. I get to travel. You know, if we could just fix the weight, and I don't even want to be a normal body size, if I could just be less fat, I'd be happy. And this is just the words in my head. This is how I think, right? And I was so surprised when I came into program and I started working it and I realized, oh my gosh, like 99% of my life is a complete mess. And maybe 1% is okay. You know, so it was a complete, complete shock for me. So what happened was, first of all, I got a new family doctor and she wanted to do a full physical, which I hadn't done in like 5 years because I hate doctors. And, you know, I don't know about you, but like when I was overweight, I never wanted to go to the doctor. What are they going to tell me? You're overweight. Surprise. I knew that. So I went to the new family doctor and she did the whole physical. And then she pulls out the BMI chart, which I hate. And, you know, she pulls out that awful thing. And she's like, Crystal, you are no longer on the chart anymore. You're only 5 feet tall and you're over 250 pounds. You're not on the chart anymore. And if you lose 100 pounds, you will finally be in the obese category. And if you don't lose over 100 pounds, you have been in the ER more times than you should, anyone like at your age should be, you're not going to make it very long. And you know, that terrified me. And I was like, okay, wow. Okay. That's significant. I'm not even on your piece of paper. Okay. Tell me what I need to do. Okay. I'll pull out the diets. I'll pull out the, you know, I'll go to the gym, you know, tell me what I need to do. And she said, don't bother. Nobody's ever lost 100 pounds, more than 100 pounds and kept it off. You need to do the bariatric surgery. And I remember, first of all, just being so shocked that she didn't think I could, like, that I needed to be surgically altered to stop eating food. Like that just, I remember like just shocked me that my doctor didn't even think it was possible for me anymore. And then I went home and I know nothing about the bariatric surgery because for me, thank you God, I didn't do it. But all I know about the bariatric surgery is the result of one Google search. So I literally Googled bariatric surgery. I saw what you had to eat after the surgery. It said cottage cheese and that was it. It was like, hell no, hell no. I don't care what happens to me. Nothing makes me eat cottage cheese. You know, so I was like, absolutely not. That's not an option. And then that summer I was in France with my best friend. We were at this pilgrimage place and, you know, we were sitting in this cafe and we were eating French bread and butter and we knew I needed to do something. She knew about this doctor's visit and everyone in my life knew that something needed to happen because I was just not really in a bad situation. And, you know, she looked at me eating my bread and she was like, huh, you know, I guess that's one of the last times you get to eat that. So you better enjoy it, you know? And I remember in my head, like nothing changed outside, but in my head, I said, no, I don't care what happens. I will eat what I want to eat and I will die doing it. I don't care. And it never occurred to me that that is insane. A 30-year-old girl willing to throw her life away for bread and butter, like insane. And it never occurred to me. I remember, and I don't know about you, like when I make a food decision, it literally doesn't matter what you say, what you do. You could be dying in front of me. Show me that I will end world hunger if I don't eat that thing. I don't care. Once I've made the decision, it's like a wall goes up and I'm going to eat that thing. That's it. You know, and that was the kind of decision I made. I know. And the next day I was at this, you know, at this place, it's a pilgrimage place. I was lighting these candles and I'm praying, you know, and I remember thinking to myself, like, Crystal, that was a pretty important decision that you made, you know, like that you're going to die and just eat what you want to eat. You should probably confirm that that's your, you know, that's your conviction. Like that's your decision. And I remember in that moment, I just couldn't bring back the conviction. It was just gone. That decision to die was just taken away. I have no other way to describe it. And I remember standing there thinking, God, I know this is you. I know you've done something here. And you've taken this decision away, but then you need to provide a solution. Because ever since I've been like 12 years old, I've done everything that I know how to do. I've done everything that my parents know how to do, or my teachers, or my family and friends. I have no other solution. You need to step in and give me one if you don't want me to die of this disease or of just overeating. And that's when I came back to Toronto and my best friend calls me up and she says, hey, you know, I was watching this show on Netflix. It's called This Is Us. And there's a girl on that show. She's in a food addiction program. And I Googled it. And there's actually one in Mississauga. It's called Overeaters Anonymous. Please don't be mad at me. I'll come with you to the meeting if you want. You know, because if anybody called me with any kind of diet scheme, it's like, click, I'm not interested. And for the first time, I was like, okay, I'll go, you know. And I looked it up and obviously, you know, I procrastinated for another 3 or 4 months because I'm a compulsive overeater. And then I finally showed up to my first OA meeting. And actually, I think it was, first of all, like at that meeting, it was like, oh my gosh, there are other people like me. There are other people who drive up to drive-thrus and pretend to be ordering for a family of four when they're really just ordering for one person, who pretend to call somebody on the phone to confirm what the family of four order is so that it doesn't look like you're ordering for one person, you know? And it was like, oh my gosh, there's other people like me. And I heard somebody say, you know, that she hadn't eaten fast food in 5 years and she didn't look upset about it. Like she looked happy, like she was free. And I'm like, what? How can that even be possible? And like, why would she lie about something like that? And why in the world does she look happy about it? You know, it's just, it blew my mind. And I remember she, you know, I was kind of on the fence after that first meeting. Literally, it was the smallest meeting you can imagine. It was in my small, like in Mississauga. It was, there were literally three people out of which only I was one of them. And the other one was another newcomer. And there was another person. That's it. You know, so it was the smallest meeting ever, dingiest church basement, you know, and I was kind of on the fence. And she said, you know, why don't you come back next week? There's someone who comes to this meeting who lost over 300 pounds and kept it off for 8 years. And I remember being like, whoa, my doctor said that that's not even possible. I see this person in like in the flesh. And I showed up the next week and I saw this person and I'm like, okay, tell me what to do. Tell me what to do. And they told me, okay, make a list of your alcoholic foods. I did that. You know, they told me get a sponsor. I did that. And then I started to play. Then I started to play with the program to see how much I really do have to do, how much I really don't have to do. You know, so what I'd like to share with you, especially because you, you know, they said this is a lot of newcomers at this meeting. I'd like to tell you how not to recover. So if you'd like to not recover, do all these things that I did in the beginning. All right. So in my first year, these are some of the things that I made, like mistakes that if I could go back and redo it, this is what I wouldn't do. First of all, I didn't follow my sponsor's instructions. I just, like, she'd give me, you know, she'd give me, I saw her instructions as suggestions, like, you know, and she would say, do these three things. And I would think to myself, okay, off those three things, it's probably just number one's really important. And the other two are not that important. So I'll just do number one, you know, or Crystal, do these three things. And it's like, you know, she wants me to do these three things, but she wants me to probably get to this outcome. And I can get to the same outcome if I go this way. And this way is so much easier. So I'm going to go this way. Or my favorite one is my sponsor would say, do these three things and be like, excellent idea. Super good idea tomorrow. Like just, I just can't do it today because I've got this, this, and this, but tomorrow for sure, I'm going to get that done, you know? And this is how I play around, right? I thought that I could decide what it would take for me to recover, that everyone else needed to do this, this, and this, but I could just pick and choose which ones I needed to do. And I remember that. And then what I came to realize is that when I got really desperate was when I realized that I started to treat my sponsor's suggestions as just instructions. I came up with, I'm very proud of it. I came up with my own OA slogan And I used it throughout my entire first year. It saved my life. I'm a very good church girl. Like, I don't swear at all, but this is the only time I swear in my head. And the slogan is, just get it the F done. Nobody asked you if you like it. Nobody asked you if it's a great idea. Nobody asked you if you can do it. Just get it done. That's all. Because the moment my sponsor would suggest something, my first thought, I'm not even joking, was that's stupid. That was just always my first thought, like, that, what, you know? And so my instant reaction is just get it done, Crystal. You can debate if it's a great idea after you get it done. The second thing was, I didn't put down all the food behaviors and all the food quantities. Oh my gosh, that is the worst way to try and work the program. Because, you know, they say that 99% abstinence is torture versus 100% abstinence is a lot easier. Because that 1%, you will spend your whole time in your head playing, well, when can I eat it? And what should I do? How can I find a different way to eat it? And like, constantly in your head, you know, and it's constantly kicking up that craving. So it's like torturing yourself. It would have been so much easier if I just put down all the food behaviors and all the food quantities, because that was huge for me. And I actually found that my food behaviors were much harder to put down than the foods themselves. The fact that, like, not eating Nutella and chips was a lot easier than not eating in between meals, or not going for that second helping of food, or not eating in front of Netflix. Those were a lot harder than putting down the foods themselves. You know, so, but I had to put them all down, and the quantities was very hard. I don't know about you, but I get this thing where it doesn't even matter if it's abstinent food. Like, if I see a huge plate of food, I get this feeling that's like, okay, everything's going to be fine. You're going to be safe because the food will never run out. And that is not a normal reaction to food. Food is not supposed to give me that reaction, you know, and that's the effect. I get an effect out of just quantities of food, even abstinent food. So I had to put them all down, the foods, the food behaviors, and the food quantities. And for me, from then onwards, when that sunk into my head, first of all, there was no diet mentality went right out of my head. There's no such thing as good days, bad days, clean days, sloppy days, nothing like that. There is no sloppy food and clean food. My alcoholic foods, behaviors, and quantities are rat poison. That's how I see it. Whether I eat one tablespoon of rat poison or a cup of rat poison makes no difference. The only question for today is, did I consume rat poison? If I did, I'm dead. That's it. There is no such thing as like, oh, okay, you know, it's the problem is the, like, you know, the way I used to think was like, if I eat one bite, it's okay, as long as it doesn't lead to the binge, because the binge is fatal. What I came to realize is that one bite is fatal. It's not the binge that's fatal. It's the one bite itself that's fatal. So I see all my alcoholic foods, behaviors, and quantities as rat poison now. And so they're not in my head. They're not treats. I don't look at them like, oh, like if I'm at my, like yesterday I was at my family's house and they had, you know, they were all eating cake and everything. If I start looking at that cake, like, oh, I wish I could have that. I remind myself that that's rat poison. For them, it's not. And that's great. But a sane person does not look at rat poison and go, oh man, I wish I could eat some. No, it's like, thank you, God, get that toxic substance away from me. You know, the next thing is I did not focus on the big book in the beginning. And, you know, maybe for other people, like the other literature that's out there works for them. And that's great. For me, I was just way too sick. I needed the instructions that worked for the millions of people from the 1930s up till today, the first 164 pages of the big book. For me, this was the message of depth and weight that I needed to hear. And it saved my life. So I needed to work the steps through these instructions in the big book, just the way that it was outlined, you know, and for me, as I read these people's stories, as I read these instructions, you know, from all the stories in the big book, the one that I relate to the most is the one that's not even true. It's the only story in the big book that's not a true story, which is the jaywalker. You know, that's the only story that's actually not true in the big book. And that's the one that I'm like, that is me. The man that keeps jumping in front of cars just to get the thrill of it. And then he figures out that he cannot stop even when he wants to, even when his life depends on it, even when his sanity and everything's being taken away. That was me. And when I read these stories in the big book, I need to know that this is life and death, because it is. My disease at 30 years old, it almost killed me. And if I go back out, there's no coming back for me. It will finish the job. I know that. So there is no there is no way out for me. This is the only way. Doesn't matter what program asks of me, there is no other solution for me because I don't want to die of this disease. The fourth is that I didn't want to make calls. I just didn't want to call people. My sponsor kept saying to me, take the We Care list home, take the We Care list home. It's the list that at my meeting, everyone writes down their phone number and one person from the meeting calls them all during the week to say, you know, how are things going? How's program going? And I was like, what am I going to say to them? Like, I'm going to be an inconvenience. Like, I don't want to call people and so awkward. And, you know, and what I came to discover is, first of all, there is nobody in program who likes making calls. I'm not unique. There's literally not a single person who likes making calls in program. Nobody came in here thinking, oh my gosh, I get to make an outreach call. Yay. Not a single person that I've ever met did that. And second of all, nobody likes chemotherapy either. But that's not the reason we do it. It's not because it's fun. It's because I don't want to die of cancer, right? So that is why I made my calls in the first year, was because I didn't want to die of this disease. And if it meant I had to pick up the phone a couple of times a day and call another fellow and say, hey, can you, like, how's recovery going? Tell me about program. I'm willing to do that, you know? So that was, making calls saved my life. I cannot tell you the number of times I was like ready to eat. It was my mind was right there. And I picked up the phone. I called another compulsive overeater and I didn't die that day. You know, I can't. And the thing is that I don't make calls when I need them, because what I have to do is I have to make calls every single day, because that is practice for on the day when I really, really, really need that call. On the day when I really, sorry?
10 more minutes. Sorry.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. On the day that I really need the call, that cannot be the first day I'm making a call. And by then I need to know who my fellows are. Who are those strong fellows that I can reach out to who when they speak, it just gets to me. It just gives me hope and inspiration. And I don't want to pick up that food anymore. I need that fellowship. And the only way to do that is to make calls every single day. Doesn't matter how I feel, what I think, whether it's a good day, bad day, happy day, sad day, I make calls every single day. And that saved my life in my first year. The fifth one was, I went on a lot of vacations. I put myself through a lot of stress for no reason. I went on a lot of vacations. I went to a lot of restaurants. And it's not that you can't do that. And don't get me wrong. Today, I can go anywhere, wherever I want. I can sit and watch my family all eat cake. And I'm like, doesn't make a difference to me. You might as well be eating dish detergent. You know, wonderful for you. You know, but in the beginning, it was hard. And I put myself through a lot of angst. Like, I remember I took a trip to France in my first year of recovery. First of all, I almost broke my abstinence there. Second of all, I barely got to see France. I was mostly in my hotel room, calling my sponsor, getting onto meetings, you know, writing, praying. And I'm like, I've spent thousands of dollars to sit in my hotel room in France, you know. And even when I was out, I couldn't bear to look up. I was like, while I was walking, I was looking at the pavement because there were pictures of ice cream and Nutella everywhere. And I was like, I can't bear to look at it. And I remember calling my sponsor and being like, you know what, that's it. I'm done. This is not fair. You know, my best friend gets to go out and eat whatever she wants and enjoy France. And here I am sitting in my, you know, in my hotel room. And she's like, Crystal, you know, I get it. It's not your fault. You're a compulsive overeater, but it is your responsibility what you're going to do with it. And you are choosing to use your vacation time to travel. And is that really the wisest thing if you're not even going to enjoy the travel? You know, so after that, I realized that I need to give myself some time and space to just work the steps and recover. Today, I can go wherever I want, but in the beginning, it's hard. I didn't walk through certain aisles in the grocery store because there's no reason I should be in that aisle ever, you know? And I know when I'm there and it's me and the food, I lose every time. So I don't ever put myself in that situation, not in the beginning. The sixth is, I thought other people were responsible for my recovery and my abstinence. So when I went over to my mom and dad's house, it was like, everybody needs to understand, like, Crystal doesn't eat this, this, and this, you know, and you really, you know, shouldn't be eating next to me. And like, guys, don't you know I'm supposed to eat at 6 p.m.? How come the food's not ready at 6 p.m.? You know, it was everyone else's responsibility to keep me abstinent. And what I realized very quickly, that it is nobody's job to keep me abstinent but me. It doesn't matter where I go, where I am in the world, what time it is, what's going on. It is my job to keep me abstinent. I remember when I had a surgery and I knew I was going to be loopy after, all my food was cooked. And I gave my mom instructions about what to do. And even when I came back, I made sure I knew what I needed to eat that day. And I had everything planned out. You know, when I go out to some, I remember when I travel with my family, they eat whenever they want to eat. They eat throughout the day, actually. So it really doesn't matter to them. I eat 3 times a day, nothing in between. And trust me, when you eat at 6 a.m., you're hungry by 12. And when you eat lunch at 12, you're hungry at 6, you know? So I can't be waiting until 9 p.m. That's a good way to like kill a compulsive overeater, you know? So for me, what I do is I would carry my food with me, you know? So if I ever needed, I had food with me. I could just stop wherever we were, eat my food and move on, you know? And when I go to parties and things like that, I bring my food with me as well. And I don't make it anybody else's job. You know, it's like, oh, Crystal, would you like this? Or, you know, can I serve you this? Can I make you this? Oh, no, thank you. Don't worry about me. I don't need to explain to them. Oh, you know, I don't eat sugar and I don't eat this and I don't eat that. It's not their job to know. It's not their job to understand any of this. I barely understand most of this. I'm just doing my best to work the program to the best of my ability. Just no, thank you. This is my job and my responsibility. And then I only worked the tools of the program. I didn't work the steps. So I remember at one point I got super into it and I'm like, here I am. I'm making calls. I show up at the meetings. I show up early. I like put the chairs away. I like, you know, I was doing service and all the tools. You name the tool, I was using the tool, but I was not working the 12 steps. And that's where my sponsor was like, Crystal, if you're not going to work the steps, I need to go work with somebody who's willing to work the steps, you know? And I realized like this, the tools can't help me. They can only help me for a short amount of time. But at some point I'm going to eat again. It's like, you know, asking me not to eat is like holding my head underwater and saying, don't breathe. I'm going to have to come up for air. Right. And all the tools give me is like an oxygen tank for a little while. It'll hold me. It'll tide me over while I'm working the steps. That's all. The oxygen tank runs out. What the steps do is they actually transform me into the kind of organism that can breathe underwater. That's what the steps do. Thank you very much. The steps transform me into the person that doesn't have an obsession for food. I don't wake up in the morning wanting that food anymore. And that's not something anyone other than God can do for me. So what am I like today? First of all, I don't work my program. Whenever people call and ask me, how's your program going? I'll tell them my program sucks. I worked my program for 30 years and it sucked. It almost got me dead. I work the program, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to let go of all my old ideas, all my ways of thinking, and just come to God and ask for his protection and care with complete abandon. And today I'm in a normal body weight. That was never in my dreams. I never even dreamed of being in a normal body weight, you know? And like, I don't know how much of weight I've lost because I don't step on a scale. I don't care what's on the scale. That number never helped me. But what I do know is that my dad doesn't recognize me. Like I'll be in church and I'll be like, yeah. And he won't recognize me. He'll have to come up after and be like, I'm so sorry. You just look so different, you know? And actually border security didn't recognize me when I was coming back from the US. I had to explain who that was on the passport. That was very interesting. But you know what? The best part is I don't need a policeman. I don't need my sponsor to like be like, Crystal, do you do this? Do you do that? Are you eating this? Are you eating that? I don't even wake up wanting that food. It's like, good riddance. You took 30 years of my life. I'm not giving you 1 second more. I'm out there living life. I don't live to eat. I just get to live my life. You know, it's not just 3 meals and nothing in between. It's 3 meals and life in between, God in between. Emotionally, I have, oh my gosh, I have so many relationships now. Like they're actual relationships and they're blossoming. Like people tell me that I'm thoughtful. I'm like the most self-centered person you can imagine. All my entire day is just filled with me. That's all I think about all day, you know? And people tell me that I'm like, they say I'm kind. I'm selfless. I don't even know. And this is not me waking up today and being like, okay, Crystal, today you're going to be a kind person, you know? Because honestly, if I did that, you know what you'd get? You'd get Ned Flanders from The Simpsons, because I don't know how to be a kind person. I don't know how to be a selfless person. The best I can do is a really, really bad impression of what I think a kind and selfless person would be like. And that is not a nice thing to see, you know? But when God transforms you on the inside, just by working the steps every single day, it just comes from the inside and other people notice before you do. Like today, you know, I used to have the worst relationship with my mom. I used to hate her. I couldn't get her to like talk to me for like 2 minutes without checking Facebook, you know? And today my mom will just call and chat. Like she'll just be chatting with me for like 40 minutes. It's just ridiculous. I can't even imagine, you know? And oh my gosh, all over my step work and inventory, like you're a doormat. Everyone treats you like a doormat. And today, you know, I don't have to protect myself from anybody. I don't have to stand up for myself and be like, no, you know, I'm making a decision. I'm putting my foot down. I'm drawing a line in the sand. You know, mom, you know, I don't care if you're manipulating me. I'm going to say no. You know, I don't have to do any of that stuff because I'm not afraid of anyone. Nobody can hurt me because God is protecting me. Of all the people that ever tried to protect me, I am the worst. I am just the worst. The only person that's protected me well is God. You know, and today my sponsor always says, Crystal, you're not a doormat. You're a welcome mat. So even when people mistreat me, even when I know sometimes my mom's an Indian mom, they use guilt and shame and, you know, and manipulation. That's just part of the culture. I'm just going to say it, you know, so like when she does those kinds of things, I don't have to be mean. I don't have to push back. I don't have to protect myself. It's like, okay, mom, if I can help you, I'll help you. If I can do what will make you happy, I'll do what will make you happy because I'm not afraid of you. I love you, you know, and that's where I go from doormat to a welcome mat. And spiritually, oh my gosh, I have a real relationship with God today. Like I actually talk to him out loud most of the time, you know? And like, I have this, the best part is I'm not the God anymore. You know, that I have a real God who shows up in my real life. I remember this one moment, you know, it was my first year in program and I was just done. I was like, I'm done with this. I've just tried my best and this sucks and I can't do it anymore. Program is just too hard. I'm done. You know, and I remember I was driving in my car and I was like crying and I'm like, I'm just done. I'm going to call my sponsor and be like, this is it. I'm done. And on the song, on the radio, the song comes on. It's a Justin Bieber song. And it goes, don't you give up now, now, now. I won't give up now, now, now. Let me love you. Let me love you. And I don't know what any of you think, but to me, that was God. That was God speaking to me through Justin Bieber. That's my God. He speaks to me through Justin Bieber. And I just started bawling my eyes out. And I remember saying out loud in the car, I'm like, okay, you know, I'm in. If you're in, I'm in. I'll get back in. I'll try again. You know, and I called my sponsor and I got back into program. I remember one time I was at the lowest point in my life. Not lowest point in my life. I had started dating someone and broke up with him after 1 month, which to me was the first time I've ever done that. So that was pretty big. And I was very, very sad, you know, and to me that was devastating. And I was in a lot of pain. More pain because I've never been in that much pain without food before, you know, and this was the first time without any anesthesia, feeling real sadness, real emotional pain, you know, and I remember sitting in my apartment and being like, it's 10 PM. I've called all the fellows. I've called my spot. I've done all this program work. I still feel awful. This hurts too much. God, you need to show up right now, please. It's just you and me here. And in that moment, I turned on, I don't know why I did this. I had, you know, my condo was dark. I had my twinkly lights on. I put on this Elton John song and I stood up in my condo and I slow danced with God. And if anyone was looking in, because I have wall-to-wall windows, I'm sure I looked crazy, but I don't care. I know I was not alone in my condo that night because I have a real relationship with God today, who I can slow dance with in my condo. Today, God has...
3 minutes.
Thank you. I'll just finish off by saying, God has replaced my stony heart with a real live breathing heart. The point of this program is not that I don't feel anymore. I feel the highest of the highs and the lowest of the lows. I live, God has given me abstinence so I can live life to the fullest and abundantly. So I can go out there and give all of my gifts to everybody that he has put in my life. Thank you very much for letting me share. I pass.
Oh, thank you so, so much, Crystal, for sharing your experience.